Good afternoon, you're listening to Camp SK News for Thursday, August 13th. I'm Taylor Hackert. The Petersburg Indian Association recently announced that they'll be repatriating the remains of a six-month-old Thlinkit girl. She's one of three ancestors the tribe plans to inter in Petersburg, two of whom have been in the tribe's possession for over 10 years. Stephanie Akins is the Tribal Administrative Assistant for PIA, and she spearheaded the project. At a community dinner last week where they made the announcement, Akins said she's been working on repatriating the infant's remains since last May.
This is uncharted territory. There's a lot of plan objects that have been taken and returned, not many who are ancestors.
PIA applied for a grant to help cover the cost of the repatriation efforts through the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA. NAGPRA is a federal law that requires federal agencies and institutions that receive federal money to return important remains and objects to lineal descendants, culturally affiliated Indian tribes, and Native Hawaiian organizations. PIA received about $24,000 for this project. Akins said that the remains of the six-month-old girl are currently being held at the Burke Museum of Natural History and Culture in Seattle. Akins will be among a group of three traveling to Seattle on September 1st to receive the remains. They'll return to Petersburg on September 4th and will host a welcoming ceremony at the airport that day for the infant girl's return.
She has been gone away from her land for almost 100 years, and she will be back on her land for the first time on September 4th.
Akins says that the tribe will host a larger ceremony later in the fall where they will inter the remains of the girl along with the two other ancestors already in their possession. New breakwaters have been installed at Petersburg's Banana Point boat launch, about 25 miles south of town. Construction for the nearly $1 million project was completed last Friday. Banana Point is an important transportation hub between Petersburg and other communities. It was originally built by the state, but they stopped maintaining the area years ago. The anchors that held the breakwaters began to rust and fall apart. Here's Aaron Marol, Petersburg's Public Works Director.
So over the last several years, several of the booms floated off, and there were seven booms to begin with, and by the end, last winter, the final one finally broke free of its anchor system, and we had four of them tied to the beach in various locations.
In 2024, the borough received a $900,000 grant for the project from the Denali Commission, a federal organization that helps support projects in rural Alaska. However, the lowest bid the borough received for the project was nearly $80,000 more. Petersburg's tribal government, Petersburg Indian Association, stepped in and provided the remaining money to the borough. Morrell says the replacement will improve safety in the area.
This will create a safer boat ramp for both the water taxis and, you know, our sporting teams that go back and forth between here and Wrangell. It will for the subsistence and the commercial fishermen, particularly in the winter. They'll be able to use the ramp at during inclement weather.
All seven new breakwaters have been installed in the area. The Sikh Assembly voted to postpone a conversation concerning a major overhaul of the city's commercial transportation code last Tuesday. After several community members spoke out against the proposed changes, KCAW's Hope McKinney reports.
Sitka's current taxi code has remained largely unchanged for nearly three decades. At the Sitka Assembly meeting on August 11th, Municipal Administrator John Leach said the city has been working for several years to update it to more accurately reflect the community's current transportation landscape.
The chapter in place has remained largely unchanged since the late 1990s. The existing chapter regulates only taxis. It does not account for tours, shuttles, limousines, human-powered vehicles such as pedicabs, all of which operate in Sitka today.
The updated code city staff developed would introduce an endorsement system divided into three classes, folding in the updated transportation methods. It would not allow taxi operators to hold any other endorsements, a change Leach says is intended to ensure dedicated public taxi service. The new code would also update the existing fare structure to a flat rate system based on pickup and drop-off zones rather than a metered one.
Under the current chapter, a person who believes they're hiring a taxi at a regulated rate can find that the trip is billed as a tour or a sightseeing service at a rate the city does not regulate. That's a hard position for a passenger who has no way to know the difference, and it's not fair to the operators who do charge the published rate.
Leach said changing the city's taxi code is contentious. The, quote, painful process began with community conversations in 2022, but the city's efforts were stalled after a taxi company sued the former police chief over his interpretation of the taxi code. The case was settled last summer, allowing the city to revisit the issue.
Nobody's touched this in 27 years because every time we try to touch it, this is what happens, and most people have said this is not worth my time and energy.
Even though a few years have passed, the issue still got pushback at Tuesday's meeting, where several community stakeholders said they don't support the proposed updates and that if approved, it will hurt business. Elias Carroll works for Tidal Taxi and Tours. He said taxi demand has decreased in recent years as hotels, fishing lodges, and cruise terminals have started to provide their own shuttle service. He said a few local calls and walk-ups a day isn't enough to maintain the cost of running a taxi business.
As regulations on taxis increase, drivers will soon not be able to survive in Sitka's high costs of living.
Sig Rutter agreed. He said throughout his tenure as a cab driver in Sitka, he's sold taxi, tour, and shuttle services, and he wants to keep it that way.
I believe it's completely inappropriate for the assembly or chief of police, the administrator, to try to force us to choose whether we're going to be a taxi, tour, or a shuttle. I'm entitled to continue doing business the way I have for the last 16 years.
Assemblymember Scott Saline said he wants more public engagement before voting on the code update and suggested postponing the issue until later this year.
I'm just afraid we're going to end up with like a haul out that can't haul out boats, and we're going to end up with cabs that can't pick people up.
Assemblymember Katie Riley agreed with the postponement. She said balancing the affordability needs of residents with the needs of providers to make a living is a tough line to walk.
I would love a little bit of thought to go into this process because it has been talked about for 27 years and there keeps being impediments. So there needs to be some dedication to getting a comprehensive look at what all the comments are on this proposal, where all the little rub points are, and then what can we do about that.
Ultimately, the assembly voted unanimously to move the issue to its meeting on November 24th. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Hope McKenney.
Southeast Alaska is seeing some unseasonably warm weather for this time of year. Communities in the southern part of the region are under heat advisories for parts of this week, with temperatures forecast in the low 80s. Haines and Skagway in the Lynn Canal also have advisories. In Petersburg, today, tomorrow, and Saturday will be sunny with highs in the mid-70s. Brooke Sullivan is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Juneau.
We are definitely under a period of unseasonably high temperatures. Normally we're under all that overcast and rainy weather, and so usually around this time of year, we're starting to transition into, getting into some cooler temperatures.
She says the dry, warm weather is due to high pressure systems as well as stagnant winds. The Lynn Canal area is influenced by high pressure out of Canada. For other areas, it's periods of high pressure in the Gulf of Alaska lasting several days at a time.
We're seeing that pattern persist and don't exactly have anything to attribute it to, not like any bigger cause or reason, but just this year seeing high pressure lingering for a little bit longer into the season than normal.
Above average warm and dry conditions are expected to continue in the region for another 3 to 4 weeks.
And then I think once we get into the fall, we'll fall back into our pretty normal pattern where we start to see more atmospheric river, back to our usual overcast, rainy conditions. So at least we're going to end the summer on a high note, I would say.
While the weather is unusual in southeast rainforest climate, Sullivan says the region is not yet considered to be in a drought. The Alaska Division of Elections may have violated a 1993 federal law when it struck more than 3,000 people from its active voter rolls last month on suspicion that they are not citizens. In a 10-page memo, Attorney Andrew Dunmire at the Alaska Legislature's Division of Legal Services describes state and federal laws that appear to prohibit the action that Election Director Carol Beecher took. Democratic Representative Andrew Gray of Anchorage, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, has studied the memo carefully.
I believe the upshot is that she did not have the authority to remove folks from the active voter roll.
Separately, the Alaska chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union announced Tuesday that it was It has written the state alleging its list pruning action violates federal law. The delisting includes a lot of U.S. citizens born in other countries who got driver's licenses before they naturalized and later registered to vote. Nearly 700 Alaskans had contacted the division as of last week to say they were citizens and wrongly removed from the list. The division says it restored their voter status. The legislative legal memo says that part of the National Voter Registration Act prohibits states from conducting systematic list maintenance to remove the names of ineligible voters within 90 days of a federal election. The Division of Elections did not answer questions about the memo. Gray says the federal quiet period applies to systematic purges. The state could still remove individual non-citizens based on more specific information, but he says the elections director may have violated federal civil rights law by treating naturalized citizens differently than other citizens. Voters not on the active list can still vote, but only if they fill out additional forms. An analysis by the Alaska Beacon finds that the state's list of alleged non-citizens has grown fivefold in a year. As the Mendenhall River swells with glacial outburst floodwater, hundreds of people living in the suburban valley below spent Tuesday night and Wednesday preparing to evacuate or hunker down. The National Weather Service predicts the flood will crest today. KTOO's Alex Solomon has the story.
On Marion Drive, Ann Lind plans to watch the flood crest from her second-story balcony overlooking the Mendenhall River.
We got lawn chairs up there, and we'll just be sitting there, and that's where I've been every year.
Lynn says her crawl space flooded last year when water leaked through the HESCO barriers and a drainage pipe failed. She says she's staying again this year to protect her property.
Because if I wouldn't have stayed last year, I never would have known that I was flooding back there, and the flooding would have been way worse, because within 30 minutes of me calling for help, I had 9 guys and 5 pumps back there.
She says she's more confident her home won't flood this time. That's because the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has placed an industrial-sized pump just beyond her lawn to send water that leaks through the flood wall back over into the river. Although she plans to stay behind with her 17-year-old daughter, she says her other kids and pets will evacuate, heeding the advice of officials. Downstream from Lynn's place, on Meander Way, Locke Brown says he and his wife are optimistic about flood protection this year. Last year, the pair's crawl space and garage flooded.
If we had these pumps on the roads sitting here last year, I think we probably wouldn't have had any water in the house.
They say they're grateful for the pumps and bolstered flood wall provided by the Army Corps this year, but they're not taking any chances. They say that once the water rises high up on the barriers, they plan to evacuate to a camper they have set up outside of the flood zone. Locke is retired from the U.S. Coast Guard, and his wife still works for the Coast Guard.
We've made our living saving people when they know they should have left.
So he says the prudent thing is to leave, since there's a possibility that the barriers could fail.
It's one of those unknowns. You just, prepare for the worst and hope for the best. So we just, we feel like at this point we're just driftwood. Whatever happens is going to happen, and we're just going to have to deal with it when it's over.
Just a few blocks over on G Street, Benson Bullock says he's not too worried. He's patching a pair of waders in his garage, but not for wading through floodwaters.
Hopefully, if it's not too crazy, I'll be going fishing tomorrow.
He says he got a few inches of water in his garage during the catastrophic flood in 2024, but his house has never flooded. Bullock says he plans to put sandbags in front of the garage before the flood crests.
We have stuff moved and cleaned up. Like, we moved my boat, we'll move my wife's truck, and we'll just have my truck here in case we decide to leave.
On View Drive, many residents say they're planning to stay to try to protect their property and to look out for their neighbors. View Drive is a forested cul-de-sac that forms a peninsula jutting into the Mendenhall River. It's been hit the hardest by past floods. And for a second year in a row, the street has been left without the protection of the flood wall constructed by the city and borough of Juneau and the Army Corps. Officials have said in the past that the street has porous soil and they doubt the homes could be protected. Mandy Malott lives at the end of the cul-de-sac. She bought the house from a family she babysat when she was growing up in Juneau. It looks over Stroller White Mountain, where her father died in 2005.
It's a very spiritual place to us. It's a private place, and we'll do what we can to protect it.
She and her family are moving their belongings up onto shelves in their garage. Last year, she worked with her neighbors to have contractors put up their own HESCO barriers around a couple of properties, and she says her home didn't flood. Although a federally sponsored buyout for her home and others on View Drive might be on the table, Malott says she's emotionally tied to the place and she sees a long-term solution designed by the Army Corps as her best option.
That emergency tunnel fix gives us all a lot of hope.
She and her family are tribal citizens, and she says she's grateful for the dozens of sandbags that the Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska dropped off on Tuesday. With help from Clarice Larson, I'm Alex Solomon in Juneau.
For Canvas K, I'm Taylor Heckert.